My name is Thomas Sauersig, and I'm optimistic about human ingenuity.
The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
Welcome to The Optimist. So glad to have you with us. My name is Felix Zeltner, and on this journey presented to you by Tech by Handelsblatt, I am your guide, your pilot, bringing you some of Europe's most optimistic, most future-thinking leaders to the microphone. And today's no exception. I was stunned when I saw our guest first today, not only because he's a good-looking man, he was joining us from a almost like spaceship-like looking studio over there at SAP. SAP, you have probably heard the name before, is by now Europe's most valuable company. And Thomas Sauersig is executive board member, responsible for thousands and thousands of employees. And he is listening to customers day in and day out. That's his job. He leads the customer service division. And he's also younger than me and shaping the next generation of this huge software giant that he joined right out of school a little bit over 20 years ago. So he's been a part of shaping this organization, and he really has a strong vision for his own leadership and also for what is needed in Germany, in Central Europe, when it comes to combining leadership and technology. He is engaged with mayors, with startups, with universities, and I'm so glad that he took the time to be here with us on The Optimist. Thomas Sauersig, welcome. What do you mean by human ingenuity? Can you describe that?
I think actually when I look back to history and also the last couple of years, I believe human ingenuity was the reason how we overcome all the challenges we faced, from diseases like COVID and the likes. We found always a solution. That's the reason why I'm super optimistic and positive that we will find solutions for reducing CO2. We will find solutions for everything what we can imagine, because I believe that it's actually an endless human ingenuity which we have. And I think when you see the innovations coming out the last couple of decades and centuries, it's actually fascinating what we are capable to achieve, and also, quite frankly, how we use technology and our human capabilities in conjunction together to really lift up the prosperity on this planet.
I liked hearing that, especially in a podcast that's called The Optimist. Thomas, you are a member of the executive board of SAP SE and lead the customer services and delivery board. Now, frankly, I have no idea what that means. So let's say we met in a coffee shop instead of virtually on video today. And I ask you, hey, nice to meet you, Thomas. What do you do? So what would you actually say?
That's a great question. And let's stick with the coffee shop for a second. I mean, if you go to a coffee shop, you have special needs. You want to have a double espresso, or you want to have special milk or something like that. Basically, also coffee can be made very specific and customer for the customer experience and tailored for the customer. That's exactly what we do with customer services and delivery. We help our customers to get the most value out of our products in the cloud. And we basically combine all services, support, cloud operations, cloud infrastructure in one organization. But basically, simply spoken, everything what's happening after the contract signature with SAP, everything what gets delivered is coming out of my organization to help our customers succeed with our products.
Okay, and can you give me an example, maybe from a recent interaction with a customer, something that you learned while looking at what they're doing?
Recent interaction is good. I mean, as we speak, I guess I have on average 5 customer meetings a day in my role. And this is exciting because for sure we serve the largest of the customers on this planet. And actually, just today, I actually had a meeting with NVIDIA. NVIDIA is using our cloud ERP, RISE with SAP, but also our integrated business planning for their supply chain optimization. So all of the complicated Blackwell supply chains is optimized leveraging our software. And here actually, we basically learned also in combination with AI and capabilities of NVIDIA, how we can take that on steroids fundamentally to optimize supply chain planning. That's certainly important. Another exciting customer was Apple the other day. Apple is actually using, and most of the people will be surprised, in every Apple store, if you go into a physical Apple store, all the experience are managed with our business technology platform. When you open up or basically open up any iPad, iPhone, whatever, for the first time. For instance, the iCloud backup is managed with SAP, that it's all seamless, that you feel this experience. All with SAP, every billing, whatever. And this is for sure something where if you talk with Apple, the customer experience and how they optimize the customer experience, so there's nothing by coincidence fundamentally, is fascinating to learn that. And that's certainly something where I took a lot from, because also, as mentioned earlier, I'm responsible for the customer experience. So certainly to take that on a perfection level like Apple is certainly something where I guess SAP still has some room to improve, but certainly the challenge is accepted.
To this day, I have to say, when I open a product from this company with the Apple on it and it says hi to me without me even doing anything, it's still kind of a magic moment. Maybe it's because I'm a kid of the 80s and I just grew up with, you know, having to hard code a machine to actually get it working. But it's fascinating how far customer service have gone. And it's cool to know that you're behind so much of it. NVIDIA, on the other hand, I don't understand at all. The only thing I know is they're in the news constantly. Is there, you know, back to our coffee shop conversation, can you help me understand why NVIDIA lands so well with so many people these days?
No, I mean, with NVIDIA, basically the foundational producer of GPUs, which was the foundation to build and train all these large language models, fundamentally like OpenAI and others. So fundamentally, they built the computing capabilities, the GPUs, to train these AI models. And that's the reason why they grew so fast, so massively the last couple of years. And with the advancements of AI and the large language models specifically, for sure, that led to an explosion of their business. And quite frankly, it's most of the most scarce resources on this planet to get these GPUs. And that's the reason why, again, coming back to supply chain optimization is critical, because certainly they don't have a demand problem, but they are short on supply. And that's certainly something what we can do with software.
Back to our little coffee shop chat here. I also learned preparing for this podcast that you have a barista training, Thomas, don't you?
That's true. I'm indeed actually a big coffee fan. And in my 30th birthday, actually, it was a birthday present of my friends that we had a joint 6-hour barista course. And fascinating. I love coffee, that's for sure.
Well, coffee, I think drinking coffee is the most global thing we all do every day. Here in New York City, I have an amazing ecosystem that grew around me, coffee shops. Do you grind at home and drink your masterfully made espresso at home, or do you also have other places to go to?
I know, me also at home for sure. I have a nice coffee machine, a Siebträger. I don't know actually the English word for that one, but certainly the 14 different variables how to optimize the espresso is certainly something where I'm very much into. So certainly on the weekend when I have time, I really enjoy taking good quality time for a high quality espresso. That's for sure.
What a beautiful word, Siebträger. If anybody has an idea of how that would carry out in English, please contact us at The Optimist. And Thomas, you have been with SAP now for 2 decades, which is remarkable. I mean, it reminds us how long SAP as an organization has actually been around. I think it's half a century by now, isn't it?
That's true. I mean, SAP is 53 years old now this year. It's phenomenal. And especially in the tech industry, it's remarkable that we were capable, basically, with each innovation, with each technology disruption, that we could adjust, that we could take that on, embrace the technology, and basically serve our customers what they need. So remarkable time. And yes, for me, 21 years now with the company, time flies.
Yeah, it also means that when you started right out of university, right out of school, we were still in the pre-smartphone, pre-social media era. And I'm just envisioning this young whippersnapper Thomas walking through the door. I think I saw your first sort of like employee card. You posted it on LinkedIn the other day. What did you envision for yourself at this company? Was the word boss or board member even in your vocabulary back then?
I mean, the vocabulary is the one thing, but certainly one thing is sure, you cannot plan a career like that. It's happening fundamentally, and you also need a little bit good luck as well to be in the right time, in the right place, as it's always said, that's for sure. But yeah, it's fair to say that I wanted to learn. I loved the injunction between business and IT always in my life, quite frankly. And I thought, who is better served for me to learn about that as a company who's creating business software fundamentally? So it was the perfect combination. And the interesting piece with the tech industry is it's so fast moving. There's always a new technology. It's always evolving. And that's the reason why for 21 years, it keeps getting to be exciting for me. I learn every single day as we speak. And as long as the learning curve is on, I'm still happy with the company, that's for sure.
Yeah, what a privilege to be in an industry where learning is such a big part of the job. However, I want to push you on this. Since you started out 2 decades ago, what has changed in a way that makes you really optimistic? And I'm asking this not only because of the name of our podcast, also because many people nowadays feel overwhelmed. Some people even are scared. There's a big conversation for everybody who is a parent in what is technology actually doing to the next generation. So in your personal experience, what has changed in a way that makes you really optimistic about the future and the software industry?
I think what makes me optimistic is if you look to the facts, all technology disruptions have created more jobs in the end of the day. And if you think about the jobs which we now actually do, quite frankly, more than 60% of the jobs which are, as we speak, executed were not existing 1945. So there were new jobs which are created. I mean, we now talk about a podcast. I mean, a podcaster certainly was not existing 10 years ago, most probably even, or 15 years ago. So new jobs get created. And also now with the advancements of AI, I'm an optimist. We will create way more jobs and hopefully we will complement the human ingenuity, as mentioned, together with the technology means to really strive and create more prosperity. And that's the reason to a point, optimistic. I always believe that new technologies create more jobs. Simple example, look at the automotive industry. I mean, before we invented the car, there were a lot of people riding on horses and kutchen and whatever. And nobody would now worry about those jobs anymore because we created millions of jobs in the ecosystem around automotive. And that's something where I believe we should not underestimate the value and prosperity creation based on new technology. And that's something where I'm a deep believer that this is a benefit for humanity.
I like your horse and carriage metaphor. I'm living close to Central Park and you still get horse and carriage in there, but it's really rare. And on the streets of New York City, when you see a horse and carriage, you tend to take a photo because it's such an ancient experience in a way. And it makes me want to talk about skills though, because for a few years, I think it was now really en vogue to say, software is the future. As you said, it's creating so many jobs every day, every year. And coding is the hottest skill that everybody has to look into. And if you're a parent, if you have younger people in your environment, in your peer group, tell them to become a coder in some way, shape, or form. Coding schools popped here in New York and everywhere around the country and the Western world. And there have been entire hubs in the global South that were only built based on coding skills and programming languages. And I say that as somebody who is, just like you, not a native English speaker, programming languages seem to become the new sort of like human language. So the more coding languages you speak, the better you perform in the global economy. That was sort of almost like a law for a long time. And then now we are in the AI era. And now the claim seems to be, well, everybody can code now because you just go to, as you said before, a large language model that is SAP run, SAP fueled. And you say, code me a website. And 10 minutes later, you have your business online. What do you recommend to everyone who is listening right now and who's maybe in school themselves or has people in school that they're mentoring or helping, what do you recommend to learn to maybe walk through life like you did to build a career in a software business?
I think first and foremost, my recommendation always to follow your passion, because only if you have passion for something, you can be a high performer. If you don't like what you do, you can never high perform. And that's the reason passion is a key. Whatever is your passion, if you love coding, also in the future, independent of AI, there will always be the need for development and for very specific skills that will not be replaced entirely. But actually, I would see it more as a benefit that basically with code generation capabilities in AI, that we scale better, we simplify. And that's what we need, because the reality is the market has a scarcity of developers, for instance. There's a war for talent for the right developers. And if we can reduce that limitation and scarcity, it's actually good in that sense. So first and foremost, passion is an important topic. and follow your passion. Secondly, the reality is you need to be a lifelong learner. It's all about it. And also for yourself, the skill sets will evolve over time. I have the opportunity, as I mentioned, to learn every single day. And I think curiosity is super important for us to stay relevant fundamentally. Because the belief that you get out of college or university and then you do for the rest of your life one job is wrong fundamentally. The jobs change, your job will change. And I think everybody need to acknowledge that whatever you learn, even if you go to university, you go to coding school, you love coding, also you for yourself, your passions will evolve, quite frankly. And then you, again, can progress and do. And it's super important to stay on the learning curve, as mentioned earlier, to always have a steep learning curve. If the learning curve is flattening out, you need to do something else. You need to get out of the comfort zone to do something else. Because otherwise, you will not succeed in that sense. And that's the reason why it's uncomfortable. Again, you get out of the comfort zone. But I think that's what it is in life, to continuously learn and be curious.
So you're saying coding, to learn coding languages, is still a great and much needed skill. There's a scarcity of folks who are able to speak coding languages and to work in coding languages. So it's not going away anytime soon. But you're also saying, don't think that just because you went to an engineering school and you learned a bunch of languages, that that's going to set you for life. But how do you do that in your day to day? How do you make sure that you keep being curious? Is that something that's just in your DNA? Is it the morning coffee? Like, how do you make sure that you keep on the learning path and not flatten out? I mean, especially as a board member, you probably have so many people who say, oh yes, Thomas, you're right, Thomas. No, you don't need to know that, Thomas. We'll take care of you. So how do you make sure you keep on that track?
I mean, curiosity is certainly also a mindset and a life attitude in that sense. But you also need to challenge yourself, because the reality is, to a point, it's easy to fall back to a model where you say, okay, I'm now an expert. I stay where I am. It feels good because I know all the answers and I stay there. But then you don't personally grow in that sense. And in the end of the day, all the others will grow and then they will outperform you. And if you want to compete, then for sure, continuous growth, continuous learning will be a foundation in that sense. And that's the reason why it's super important. But again, you need to push yourself every single day. And I think if you compare it with sports, I know a lot of people who are very active marathon runners. I mean, they push themselves every day to train, to get better, to be quicker for 1 minute, for 30 seconds in the marathon. And you need to have this ambition to push yourself. And that's the same, quite frankly, with your own personal growth, your own curiosity, your own learning journey, that you continuously grow. Because if you don't grow, there's certainly somebody else of these 8 billion people on this planet who will grow. And we are in a global competition by default. And that's the reason an internal kind of competitiveness for yourself is certainly also important.
And how do you push yourself?
I think what I do fundamentally, and that's helping me always, to put our customers in the center. What can we do more for our customers? What do we need to learn to serve them better, to build better products, to do good for them? And that's something where it keeps you pushing, because also the expectations of our customers are not flattening out. They always have higher expectations. They have other competitive solutions. So they see other good things, and for sure we always need to be better. And that, if you put the customer in the center of what you do and focus on that to optimize it every single day, then you need to push yourself, because you cannot stand still fundamentally in that sense. So perhaps that's a way to do that. But it also for sure comes with an own internal ambition, what you for yourself want to deliver for quality.
And it's also a very entrepreneurial mindset, I think, to live in this world of constantly improving, constantly thinking about who you are servicing, constantly thinking about this one little thing, I think we could do that better. And you're also instilling that in our next generation. You, with SAP, work with schools like TU Munich. I used to live and go to school in Munich, know them well, and have now admired them growing so much. And you work with them directly, and you have even gone as far as co-building a new campus in Munich. So other than now lots of students using SAP software early on and growing into it, what is the reasoning behind that? What do you hope to gain here by helping a university get a new campus?
I mean, for the Technical University in Munich specifically, we even built a building on top of their campus in Garching, fundamentally, next to the university. And here, actually, we even share the building. So basically, we have roughly 600 to 700 SAP employees, but we also have 200 professors, PhD students, and the likes, which are part of the building. So to really have a close collaboration, joint rooms, that we really have an intersection between science and fundamentally the application in our business fundamentally. And for sure, we hope that we can, with that, be on the front of research, on the front of all the developments. And for sure, we also hope we get some talent, without a doubt. But also, if you think about all of our global university alliance, which we have, the reality is, in our business in tech, you always need to be at the forefront of that. Especially with AI. That's the reason we have partnerships with Stanford, UC Berkeley, UC Irvine. We have the NSU in Singapore and many, many more, where we want to tap into these talent pools, in these brains, in this brain power around the globe, quite frankly, to learn again and to get the early insights in research, what's happening. Because in the end of the day, we also need to be paranoid that we don't miss a trend, that we are on the forefront of the trends. And that's something where it's so inspirational, quite frankly, to see what's happening. And also, the word inspirational is the right word, I guess. I can tell you, if you go to the universities and see those students and what they do, it's so phenomenal what they think, how they think, what on what topics they're working. And I can tell you, for our employees, it's such a massive inspiration to see that as well. And that gives motivation, that gives employee engagements. And that's for sure also super important.
So it's an incentive for your colleagues, but it also means innovating and recruiting. Is there a concrete example, like a product or maybe even a startup that came out of this sort of co-innovation concept that you just described?
I think what we see these days is a lot in our AI activity. So in our AI foundation, there is a lot of ethical basics which we build into the product based on the collaboration, for instance, with UC Berkeley. And I think that's an interesting model. We see a lot of supply chain topic, what we work together, for instance, with the Technical University in Munich, also about mobility in that sense. I think it's quite exciting. So certainly a lot of innovations from SAP come from the inspiration from the universities. And what we should not forget, the students actually challenge us to think differently. Because in the end of the day, there's always a risk in a large corporation that you have institutional knowledge from the past, you always did it that way, and you have basically a mental mindset around things from the past. And to now have a total fresh perspective is challenging our colleagues also to think differently. What's the art of the possible in that sense? So it's a very healthy tension, which is super important to keep moving.
Fascinating. I was just envisioning you bringing a bunch of students along to a board meeting and say, sorry, guys, but, you know, these are the people we should be listening to. Is that sometimes happening, this sort of like reverse mentorship?
Actually, I would argue all board members specifically have a lot of student interactions, quite frankly, because it's super important to get these perspectives, because the reality is also people will work differently. For instance, if you think about, quote by quote, the future of work, and for sure our software is running the business processes, is running enterprises, and fundamentally millions over millions of end users use our software. But how do they want to work in the future? And what does it mean from a requirement perspective towards SAP that we basically build the software they want to use in the future? And that's something where, for sure, this is certainly pushing the boundaries and challenging us. And that's exactly what we're looking for.
Very cool. Thomas, you're a member of the board for Bitkom. You're frequently sitting together with business leaders from the digital economy, and you're involved in a lot of conversations about Germany's digital future, about maybe even the digital future of Europe. So when you think about that, what would you describe as the biggest challenge there that you are currently trying to solve?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's super important for us on the one hand side to be active in those various kind of institutions, quite frankly, to scale also the digital literacy and also the ambition, what we can do from a digital perspective, like with Bitkom, to really see what can digital transformation or digitalization in Germany or in the enterprises in Germany bring to scale fundamentally. And what you mentioned, especially now with the new election in Germany and basically also the geopolitical evolvement, if you will, there's certainly more conversation about digitalization in Germany, digitalization in Europe. What does that mean with regards to sovereignty? And the reality is, if you think about digital sovereignty. It's the new defense line for our society, for our democracy fundamentally. And that's also if you consider all the cyber threats we see around the world, because in the end of the day, we're in a hybrid war. I mean, we see pictures in the newspapers about, tanks and everything. But the reality is it's a hybrid war. We see an increase, fundamentally doubling the cyber security attacks the last year. And for sure, digital sovereignty is for every society, for every country, also for the European Union, super important. And we want to help for sure. And as European largest company and largest tech player for sure in Europe, we see our obligation to help, our obligation to educate the people what we can do and what we should do.
Let's unpack this for a minute. So we're talking about Bitkom, which is, for everybody who is not familiar with it, which is basically an association of digital companies that has been around Germany for a long time. I think, it's probably longer even than you have been at SAP.
Yeah, it's founded 1999, I guess, yes. Oh. So 5 years longer than I. So I think it's 26 years old, yeah.
Fascinating. Years, yeah. And there's all kinds of companies in there. I mean, I could imagine that, you mentioned Apple and NVIDIA in the beginning. I mean, I could imagine that these very visible public companies, they get attacked constantly, probably every second, even while we are speaking here. But I'm now thinking about thousands of members of this association, small businesses, small agencies, small startups. What are they experiencing here in this hybrid war that you're just describing, and how are you helping them? Maybe you can pick an example or two.
I think the reality is they are attacked the same because anyway, the attacks are totally automated and digital and also now with AI on steroids, and they get attacked basically as we speak. And for sure, the smaller companies don't have the right security spending and funding to protect themselves properly. And that's also where we believe the cloud and professional cloud bears is actually a solution, because who wants to protect the data center? Who wants to protect the infrastructure and hardware? Who wants to protect the various network layers? And if you go to the cloud, a professional player is doing that. And that's the reason why we see so many customers coming to SAP and say, hey, we want that you actually operate our systems, and we want to go to the cloud because I don't want to worry about that anymore. And I know you spend so much on cybersecurity, so I trust you that you take care about that one, that I can fundamentally take care about my real business. Because quite frankly, running data centers is only for a very limited amount of companies the real core business in the end of the day. So it's for all the others just a supporting function. And that's something where for sure they should go to professional players, because the risk profile is quite frankly super similarly than also with the big ones.
Interesting. So no matter if I'm a mayor of a town, or I have a little barbershop, or I'm Apple, I have the same kind of exposure to cybersecurity threats.
Absolutely. A lot of people, actually, I guess even a lot of companies are hacked and they don't recognize it. And for some, you see the ransomware attacks where basically they need to pay or have these conversations about getting their data back. I mean, this is increasing. I can give you one fact. In Germany alone, the problem statement with cybersecurity threats which happened is in the 260 billion losses which the company made and cost occurred based on cybersecurity issues. 260 billion in an economy which is 4.4 trillion GDP. So it's 5% fundamentally, if you will.
Where is all the money going? Where are these 260 billion?
I mean, that's where companies need to spend to other companies to help them to get back the data, to pay for the data, to restore the network in an appropriate fashion. There's a lot of cost associated to all of that. And that's what's happening. Yeah, it's a big problem.
Thomas, you basically say, and I understand, you are the board member that takes care of customers in the cloud. You're saying, you know, in this time we're living in, and there is a rude awakening right now when it comes to Europe being on its own in so many places. In the time we're living in, the cloud is a very good place to be. I sometimes feel
it's the place
I
to
even
be.
Want to be in the cloud sometimes and not going out there. Do you sometimes dream of just living in a cloud and not being on Earth?
No, I'm actually a down-to-earth guy, that's for sure. But from a technology perspective, cloud is the place to be specific. Absolutely.
And of course, we are talking about digital sovereignty here. You mentioned the word already, because the term, I think it was long on the fringes of kind of what we're talking about in tech, and now it's mainstream. So Rolf Schumann, who was the opening guest on this podcast with Schwarz Digis, who is the co-host of the tech conference in Heilbronn in May, he basically said, well, we have to build our own infrastructure here. in Europe. And yes, we can build them maybe with the help of some of the US companies that of the names we all know, but we also have to build them ourselves. How far are we in doing that? How far is digital sovereignty in Europe, Thomas, in your personal opinion? Let's say on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 non-existent, 10 full scale there, ready to use.
I think perhaps 3 to 4, fundamentally, or 4 to 5, if you're a little bit more optimistic. I think I see just so much more upside in Germany, in Europe, for digital sovereignty, to be quite honest. Certainly something what we need to work on. As mentioned, if we truly believe that the world is as I described, then again, I repeat myself, but digital sovereignty is the new defense line for our society. And that's the reason why we need to invest into that significantly. And to have alternative infrastructures is always a good option, because again, this optionality is an important factor. If it will be then only an alternative factor, that I don't believe. But again, I think optionality is key for sovereignty as well. And then also we need to be clear on the definition, what is sovereignty? When we talk about sovereignty as a company, we fundamentally have four dimensions which is relevant. On the one hand side, you have a data sovereignty, you have a technical sovereignty, you have an operations sovereignty, and super important, also a legal sovereignty. And we should not underestimate that one. Google Maps, one day after Trump said it's called Gulf of America, it was Gulf of America around the globe. Even if you go in Germany on Google Maps, it was called Gulf of America. That's a question, what level of sovereignty do we have in that one? Is if a company is just changing that back and forth without any more global consultation whatsoever. And that's something where for sure legal sovereignty is also key, that not a president can just say, I want the data of this customer, and then an American company needs to hand in that data. That's for sure legally different in Germany. We are a German company. That would never happen here in that sense. And that means also legal sovereignty is a key aspect, just to give some examples here. But again, these four dimensions are super critical, that they all come together at once.
I have an advice or some kind of example for you here that I just learned from NASA when they had their latest landing days. They just said west of Florida, which I think is a very elegant way of not using any term.
Instead, west of Florida, that's good.
West of Florida. It's like, you know, when we in New York, we talk about the people on the other side of the river, we just say west of New York. We don't use New Jersey a lot. So I feel like that's maybe a good way to work around it. But
the question is, should we work around it? That's the philosophical question. Should we work around it? Should we accept it? Or should we be self-sovereign in some of these decisions? And that's the philosophical question for governments on this planet. And for sure, again, specifically Germany and Europe.
And what do you respond to that?
I think Germany need to be sovereign in that sense with our capabilities, that we can for sure, again, defend the respective society and democracy, absolutely.
And where are your data centers at the moment? And maybe also, where are you planning to build the next ones?
That's a good one. So as a company, for sure, we have a global spread of data centers. We have more than 140 data centers around the globe, also leveraging partner data centers or partner infrastructure as a service providers from the usual suspects, so to say. But we also have our own internal data centers, SAP-owned data centers, in more than 15 locations as well. So we have a global spread, and that gives us for sure opportunity. And for sure also in Europe, we have data centers in various locations in Germany, in the Netherlands, and the likes, where we own the infrastructure 100%. And then again, we also scale with partners, quite frankly.
When I pressed Rolf Schumann on this from Schwarz Digits, he said, well, we also work with Google, maybe less so with Microsoft now, because Google gives us more freedom to do what we want to call sovereignty. How do you deal with that? Because it's complicated. In the end, oftentimes, you have to sit in a boat with a hyperscaler, a big company that is based out of the US. So can you maybe share some of the steps you're taking to avoid this sort of like over-reliance on the US and really build within Central Europe?
I think the good piece is with SAP. Basically, we are developing business applications and business platforms. So we are on top of the infrastructure as a service stack fundamentally, so which means we are agnostic and we have the flexibility. And that, again, this optionality gives us sovereignty. So we are not over dependent on any US-based infrastructure technology. As I mentioned, we also have 15 own infrastructure and data centers. So we have our own infrastructure as well. So we are not reliant on any US hyperscaler, for instance, in this specific regards, which gives us, again, the opportunity in that sense. And as we speak, for instance, also the BSI is, for instance, certifying our data center for so-called VS NFD, so for restricted and security cleared information from the government. So we have this optionality, and the benefit from our perspective is that our software can run basically everywhere in that sense. So I think that's the advantage.
Okay. And, well, let's go back to leadership in these uncertain times. When a situation occurs, like a black swan, like something you really didn't expect, have you found a mantra or a framework for yourself that you apply that you can share with us?
I mean, first and foremost, in whatever situation you are, it's always advisable to stay calm, quite frankly, and first look at the facts and analyze the facts, and don't feel pressured about anything in a quick time, because usually it's always a good idea to first sleep over something to get a clear mind before to take any irrational or emotional decision in that sense. So it's always good to first have the facts clear and then take fact-based decisions. That's always helpful, and whatever happens, that will guide your way. I think what is super important for yourself in all of this situation, that when you wake up in the morning, look into the mirror, that you can look into the mirror and you know you did your utmost best what you could do, that you're always clear with yourself fundamentally. And I think that's super important, that you're rooted and grounded in yourself, that you know you did whatever you can in this situation. And whatever happened, sometimes, as you mentioned, you cannot influence it, but you can make the best out of it and you need to deal with it. And that keeps basically the calmness which is required, because especially if you lead hundreds, thousands, ten thousands of people, it's even more important, quite frankly, that you show this sovereignty or this seniority in that sense, because all these people will look for guidance. They will look for help. How do they deal with it? How do we judge it? And if they see nervosity in that one, that trickles to the entire organization and will kill your productivity, because people will chat in the coffee corners instead of focusing on the work. And that's the worst what could happen. I mean, SAP, for instance, now is more than 110,000 people strong. If only 1% productivity would go down based on nervosity because people chat in the coffee corner, oh, do we have a future or not? That is equal to 1,100 people. Think about what kind of businesses you can build up with 1,100 people, which you just lack by don't giving sufficient clarity and leadership to people or to motivate them even more. And that's the reason why actually the most productivity gains you can get out of companies is to raise the motivation level and employee engagement a little bit, that they go above and beyond, because that's the extra productivity gain in that sense, what is usually underestimated sometimes in all of these equations. Because if all colleagues are lined up to the same goal and go the extra mile, this is where you know that you can move mountains as a company. And that's the difference in the market in the end of the day.
How many people are you directly responsible for at this point?
38,000.
And one example of how you try to motivate them?
I mean, what I think is super important is clarity and transparency in communication. People want to know the truth. It doesn't help if you make buzzwords around it or some nice stories around it. I mean, they're all highly well-educated people. So the more clearer you are with your perspective and the more clearer you communicate, the better it is. And for sure, from a motivational perspective, you always need to be able to draw the line. What's the art of the possible if we take it higher with the technology we have in our hands, how we can serve our customers, and fundamentally, the purpose we have in our roles to, again, help our customers succeed. Because in the end of the day, if the employees don't see the purpose in their role, in their job, I mean, how, again, should they have this passion and with that unleash that performance, what I talked earlier about, to be a high performer if you don't have the passion? So you need to make it relevant. You need to make it in a way that companies want to stand up in the morning to say, look, I now fight for good here. And that's then a machine which you build up, which is changing the game.
Mm-hmm. I have a favorite leadership question from a friend of mine who runs a community for leaders, actually. When was the last time you woke up at 3 a.m., Thomas, and thought, this is all my fault?
Fault is actually fault is always a difficult point, because absolutely you will do mistakes, without a doubt. But hopefully you will do the mistakes, as mentioned, with the right facts and the right data before. And with the insights you had in that moment of time, perhaps it was the right decision, even if the decision proves wrong 2 weeks later or 1 month later, because there's new information coming, there's new market changes, whatever. And if you base your facts on data and to make the best decision in that moment of time, unemotionally, at least it's not always a question about fault, it's my fault, other fault. It's what we learn out of that. And what do we need to do for the next decision we take to be better? But for sure, if a failure culture is super important for companies to openly talk about failures and what you do wrong. I, for instance, a couple of years back, I did a reorganization, which was not ideal. And I changed it actually only half a year afterwards. And I went on stage for all of my employees and said, well, it was a wrong decision. And I acknowledged that. And now I learned something new. And that's the reason we changed it. And to also be able to be that honest to the employees, that will show that you trust them. And trust on both sides is super important, coming back to the clarity and transparency and communication and everything. So all of this is a system which needs to come together. And in the end of the day, it will show if you are authentic, because employees will recognize in a second if you're not authentic. And if you just play a role, if you just say something because you believe you need to say something, and that's not helpful. So always be, again, authentic, clear, straight. And then you also, again, can every morning look into the mirror and know you did your utmost best, and that can is important.
Sounds like you don't wake up at 3 a.m. a lot.
Actually, happens occasionally. If my little one wakes me up in the morning when she comes over. She's 5 years old now, but still it happens occasionally. So certainly, sometimes happens. But from a business perspective, I can absolutely sleep well at night. That's for sure.
That's great. We have a 7 months old at home right now, and he likes to give keynotes at 3 a.m., which is really interesting. Just
I can only imagine.
Starts talking and shouting, and it's really the confidence is incredible. The timing not so great. Talking about the reorganization, you just said. And I wanted to ask you one last leadership question before we end on talking about the future of SAP. What would you describe was the toughest leadership challenge that you had since you stepped into leadership roles at SAP? And how did you overcome it?
I think the toughest decision was in the year 2020, when we as a board decided that we change our strategy and financial model. That led actually with the announcement to a 30% drop in the stock price, which is for sure massive for all of the investors, for everybody. And it was a decision where we knew when we changed the financial model that this would happen. We knew that would happen. And we knew that will raise concerns on the investor side, on the analyst side, on customer side, partner side, and on the employee side about, oh, what's the future about SAP if the stock price just went down 30%? But we did it with the conviction that we need to invest into our customers. We need to invest into the cloud. We need to change our business model really significantly. We need to do this transformation now. Otherwise, SAP will not have a bright future for the decades to come. And we are here. We want to build a company which is lasting for decades. I mean, we are 53 years old and we intend to have it for the next decades. And we want to prove that also here with the next technology revolution, that we can basically drive that change. Fast forward now, 4.5 years later, we have just announced the most valuable European company with our market cap. So it proves that this transformation was right. We have a significant increase in our cloud revenue. We now have a total cloud backlog of 63 billion, actually, which with a significant growth rate in our cloud backlog and cloud revenue, even on these high numbers fundamentally. So I think it's now proving that this hard transformation was right, but it was brutal because, again, there was doubts on all stakeholder groups, and it took 2.5 to 3 years till the people saw that this transformation will work. And I believe it's fair to say that going through such a transformation is super, super hard, especially when a lot of people don't see that it really will work out in the end. But for sure, as leaders, you need to have conviction. You need to have conviction about the company, about the customers, the market, and that you do the right thing. And you also cannot just pivot back and forth because you get some headwinds. And to stay the course to do such a significant transformation is key. I actually would go one step further. I would wish that more companies in Germany, in Europe, actually do such significant transformation. And sometimes we are too hesitant to take the bold decision, acknowledging that it will be hard. But sometimes I feel some of the industries, especially in Germany and Europe, they step by step went into the future, but not full force. And I think that's something where I hope that we see now more companies who perhaps take an example about SAP, that such a transformation is paying off while it is super hard. Certainly was one of the hardest, toughest decision. But again, now it's easy to talk about it.
Yeah, of course. Now you're in the smiling winner. Congratulations on taking the pole position here in Europe. I think Novo Nordisk is probably then now number two behind you in market cap. Talking about the future of SAP, I mean, we just had our last episode here on a podcast about agentic AI, and we learned a lot about how workflows, how entire even teams or organizations are now becoming AI supported. Do you have an example for something that is in place right now, maybe even creating value, creating revenue? Because I feel like that's where agentic AI is still a sort of nebulous, wobbly in some ways when it comes to the future of what SAP is building. Like, is there an AI agent built by SAP out there that is really actually making money for a business that you can share with us?
Absolutely. So as we speak with our digital co-pilot Joule, we evolved it into a multi-agent framework. So fundamentally, if you think about a cash collection process, we now have a cash collection AI agent who's basically collecting the cash from your basic customers in that scenario. That's already productive with customers. Or a scenario which is used heavily now also by our system integrator partners is Joule for consultants. So basically imagine that all of the SAP knowledge and certification knowledge is available in Joule. And think about how that can accelerate SAP projects and how you can simplify SAP projects. And that's certainly something where AI is certainly a big topic. And if you talk about SAP's future, I mean, it's clear that, especially if you think about agents and workflows, where is this happening? In business systems. So for sure, the future of SAP is AI, and AI is the future for SAP. And that's the reason why, for sure, we have a huge push towards AI. And also, quite frankly, to play down our strengths in that sense. So basically, 2.5 years ago, also in my former role as a product head and board member for product at SAP, we took the decision that we say, on AI, we want to play on our strengths, meaning it's the business context, the business process, and the business data. That's exactly what we have in our applications. But therefore, we also partner with the best technology players like the NVIDIAs, OpenAIs, Mistrals, Aleph Alphas, and the worlds to take the best technology, but to bring it into the context of the business. And as we all learned, I guess, the last couple of years, basically, in the end of the day, AI is only as good as data. Coming back again to our core skill, the business data and our systems. And that makes it so differentiating and so valuable for our customers and also so relevant in that sense to use our AI capabilities. And now basically we embed AI in all of the business processes. Basically, there's no process in the future without AI. That's how we think about it. And that's something where embedded AI is for us the key to also drive quick adoption. Because if you sign up to any cloud product of SAP, automatically AI is coming along with it. It's not a separate thing. It's part of the product.
Is there going to be an AI Thomas one day? Do you think the SAP is going to have an AI board member?
I'm not sure if somebody wants an AI Thomas, but if the market need for something like that is there, we can talk about it. No, I mean, as mentioned, I think, and quite frankly, as we speak, all board members actually complement our work with AI capabilities, for sure. I mean, that should be the ambition. And I challenge a lot of people, quite frankly, also in different interview rounds, also the moderators sometimes, did you prepare yourself personally for that interview with GenAI? Kind of prepare the kind of the CV, the explanation, introduction to the person, or the questions about the company, the topic, were the questions AI generated, or did you thought about yourself? And I recognize when I challenge the people about it, a lot of people think, oh my goodness, he's right, I didn't do it. And this is where, in the end of the day, I feel we need to do more and push ourselves more to embrace and really adopt these AI cases also personally and not just talk about it. Now, your challenge, did you prepare with GenAI?
I feel caught, guilty as charged. This was all handcrafted.
You see, I thought so.
Why did I do that? But I also have tried it, and you know, sometimes the questions that come out are a little bit boring. So I'm still proud that I handcrafted this interview.
Absolutely.
And we have about 2 minutes left, so I'm just going to ask you, Thomas, The tech conference by Handelsblatt is premiering in Heilbronn in May. You will be there along with many European leaders who are coming together for the very first time in this new format to build a cluster of optimism, quote unquote, which I love. I think it's a great mission to have for this gathering. You're a co-initiator with SAP, co-creating this new community. Do you have a hope for this event? You yourself going there, spending your precious time there?
No, I absolutely hope that when we bring the entire community and network together across all these industry sectors, I think that can unleash a lot of potential, quite frankly. And if we then really with optimism look at the things, what we can do actually in Europe, in Germany, bringing all this knowledge together, bringing all these capabilities together, I think there's a huge opportunity. And I truly believe that there's so much what we can do together as a team. And that's the reason why I believe it's a fantastic initiative. That's the reason why I basically from day one, when I heard about it, said, let's be part of that journey. Because if you think about now the interjection of this industry knowledge we have in Germany, the technology we have at hand with AI, the revolution, it's now the time to craft it and create it. And that's something where I feel we need to get together.
I love that you as a software leader are so optimistic about human ingenuity. It's really refreshing to hear that. And thank you for being a guest today on The Optimist. Thomas Sauer-Essig, see you in Heilbronn.
Thank you. See you.
For listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.